Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's all online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's betterhelp.com.
Copper Bullets, the four-part series from Amazing Sports Stories, is available now.
Zambia was considered as an underdog.
Are we going to do the impossible here?
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga in Nairobi, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. Plans in high gear in Ethiopia to welcome foreign banks as part of a wider government agenda to open up the economy.
Since the coming to power in 2018, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has been practicing a shift in terms of his philosophy of the government in dealing with the economy. So he had been advocating for a more reformist and then private-centered government rather than more protectionist status philosophy that had happened before him.
And we hear why the Sierra Leonean Minister for Gender and Children Affairs wants a new law in place.
We've seen that there's an increase in child labor and exploitation. We have seen that even also children in conflict with the law. And we have also seen an increase in the number of FGM cases against children. These are the main issues that we're looking at and working on in terms of reviewing the old law to get the new one.
It's Tuesday, June 18th. First, we go to Kenya. That's the sound of displeased Kenyans in the streets of Nairobi on Tuesday. They are protesting the finance bill introduced in Parliament, spelling out the country's next budget. On social media, Kenyans on X, formerly Twitter, have been mobilizing for support, urging the country to reject the bill. So why are Kenyans so spooked by the bill? Well, until Tuesday morning, the government had proposed to introduce taxes on bread, which is a staple breakfast meal, an annual motor vehicle tax, an eco levy on locally made goods, including sanitary pads, and an increase in taxes on mobile money transfer. But even before the protests gained momentum, members of parliament from the ruling party met President William Ruto and resolved to do away with the contentious tax proposals.
We have listened to the view of Kenyans, and we are all in agreement that there are two things that we must do. One of them is that we need to protect Kenyans from increased cost of living, and therefore the proposed 16% VAT on bread has been dropped. To support, again, on reducing the cost of living, we are doing something about our vegetable oil so that we do not make it expensive for Kenyans. Transfer of mobile services is a key concern to many Kenyans, and therefore, again, we have proposed that we do not have any increase on taxation or mobile phone transfer.
I've been speaking to Ken Gishinga, an economist in Kenya, to get some perspectives on why Kenyans are opposed to the finance bill. Ken, welcome to the Focus on Africa podcast.
Many thanks for having me.
Why are Kenyans so dissatisfied with this finance bill, what the government is proposing to be the budget for the next financial year starting July?
Well, I think Kenyans are starting to finally make the connection between the finance bills that have been coming and their impact on their economic situation, not just on the cost of living, but on issues of unemployment. Historically, Kenyans have been fairly disconnected, but really starting from last year with the finance bill 2023, doubling of VAT on fuel, that really made life very difficult for Kenyans because it slowed down the economy. So I think this year, Kenyans are a bit more proactive. They really are aware that some of the measures will again add to the cost of living, slow down business and contribute to unemployment. And I think this year round, Kenyans appear to be a bit more prepared and are really willing to mobilize every effort.
What other avenues then does the government of Kenya have? Going by the feeling on the street, is Kenyans really do not want to see more taxes. What other avenues do they have to raise money?
Well, what we've always called for is a progressive tax system, because what we have in Kenya right now is a regressive tax system. A progressive tax system focuses on things such as income tax. You see, the beauty about that is when you create a business environment, people get jobs, they're more than willing to part with some of that for income tax because they are growing and the country is growing. Have people get into the formal sector, get employed, then they'll need to pay money even as they continue. The model we have right now is focusing on consumption taxes. And the challenge with that is you have huge levels of unemployed people who have no income, yet you're making the cost of their everyday goods that much higher. And that's why it's called a regressive tax. It hurts the people at the bottom the most.
And the question is then, Ken, does the government have to do this? Do they have to tax the areas that they are taxing?
Well, the challenge is right now, Charles, the government is part of the IMF framework. This was a framework that the previous administration entered in with the IMF. It was originally meant to be a three-year program, so ideally this should be the final year, but it seems every year it keeps getting extended. So we had really hoped this year, this could be the last year, but for every new loans that are coming in, the program is extended. And that's also what's really getting Kenyans very livid, because the argument has always been that we are paying down the taxes, we are paying down the debt. But what Kenyans are reading is we are incurring more debt as we move forward. And these IMF programs are being extended every time we incur new debt. So for a lot of people, is they need to see light at the end of the tunnel. They understand that the IMF is pushing hard on the government to introduce some of these things, and they really want to see a trajectory towards exiting that program and really the country being able to run its own affairs.
But when you look at public expenditure and the discipline thereof, do you have a sense that the government can convince Kenyans that they are doing what they can and making the most out of every Kenyan shilling that they are collecting from all the payslips and all the businesses across the country?
Well, Charles, every headline, every social media outlet has been highlighting how much is being spent by this government on things that are not truly important. There are too many foreign trips, there are too much money going into offices that are not key. You know, the spouses of the president and the deputy have huge allocations, and people are saying, why do we need to do this when schools don't have teachers, when hospitals don't have vaccines? Why don't we focus on this? So there's a focus a lot on the luxurious lifestyles of the top tier leadership, and it's being contrasted with really difficult conditions with the ordinary citizen.
Are there any positives from this budget?
Yes, a couple of positives. I think the cost of some items such as potatoes might come down because of the reduction of the excise from the East African community. They're trying to focus on regional trade. So the excise duty from importing from these other countries, the East Africa community, has been reduced. So Kenyans might find themselves with cheaper onions, cheaper potatoes, because we import a lot from Tanzania. There's also reduction of VAT, registration for small businesses. They've increased the turnover. That's mandatory for registration, and I think that would be a bit of reprieve for SMEs.
Thanks to Ken Gishinga, Chief Economist at Mentoria Economics. Let's jump across the border now to Ethiopia, where there are plans to allow foreign banks to operate in the country for the first time in 50 years. Currently, there are 31 banks in Ethiopia, all locally owned, and the state-owned Commercial Bank of Ethiopia is the biggest of them all. It's just the latest step in a gradual process by the government to open up Ethiopia's economy after decades of strict state control. Opening up the economy has been Abiy Ahmed's pet project since he became prime minister in 2018. We thought this would be a good time to look at his reforms, what came before, and how things are changing for Ethiopians and foreign investors alike. So I spoke to our reporter in Addis Ababa, Kalkidan Ibeltal.
This is coming in the backdrop of promises and then actions to liberalize the economy and to open some of the closed economic sector to foreign investment. This is not the first time that the government has announced such a move. A few years ago, the telecom sector was opened and Safaricom became the first foreign telecoms operator to open operations in Ethiopia. And after that, there were promises that other sectors might be opened. And it seems now the financial sector is next in line. In fact, hand in hand with the financial sector, there was also other bills being introduced to open up the retail market as well.
So Prime Minister Abiy has been Prime Minister since 2018. Tell us how the economy of Ethiopia looked like before he came with this agenda to reform the economy and open it up to the rest of the world.
When he came to power 6 years ago, Ethiopia had been enjoying one of the fastest economies in the world, actually, for about a decade. It had this tremendous growth achievements, particularly in infrastructure, in manufacturing, as well as in agriculture. And that economic growth was largely driven by state investment and protectionist policy. The government before the prime minister was a left-leaning statist government that gave protection to the financial sector, to the retail market. And there were several sectors that foreigners were not allowed. To go a little bit back, Ethiopia had foreign banks and other foreign investments back in the 70s and in the 60s during the imperial era. But in the mid-1970s, there was a coup and what came was a Marxist regime that altogether banned private ownership. So for 17 years, any kind of private ownership was prohibited by law, which means everything was owned by the government. So in the early 1990s was when that Marxist military regime was toppled and a left-leaning statist government came to power. They said that the country's economy was not strong enough to allow competition to foreigners. The private sector was at nascent stage. It had to be built from scratch, essentially. So it needed time for the domestic actors, for domestic private actors to build their muscles for the country and to invite foreign investment, foreign competitors. So if you take banking and the financial sector as an example, there was a thriving domestic banking sector. There are several domestic banks, more than 20, but foreigners were not allowed in that sector. The same is true for the retail market and the telecom market. So it was being operated in that manner, but there was an understanding that at some point, foreign competitors are bound to come in.
Yeah, so is it then the view of the government at this time that the local investors and the local brands have strength to endure the competition that would come from foreign actors coming in? Is that why they are coming in now? They feel their businesses can withstand that competition? And if so, will there still be some policies that continue to cushion the local businesses from the foreign competition once it starts to come in?
Well, that's one of the reasons. There is a feeling that these sectors might be strong enough to handle some shock in terms of competition. But also there is a shift in the philosophy altogether. Since the coming to power in 2018, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has been practicing a shift in terms of his philosophy of the government in dealing with the economy. So he had been advocating for a more reformist and then private-centered government rather than more protectionist statist philosophy that had happened before him. But in addition to that, particularly when we come to recent years, in the past 5 years, the economy has been struggling massively due to ongoing conflicts in various parts of the country, as well as external factors like the COVID pandemic and wars in other parts of the world, which means that Ethiopia has been struggling to attract foreign investment. And now it seems that it's doing everything that it can to open up the market and in turn attract foreign investment. So it seems that one of the drivers of this current move is in part that desire, that need for foreign investment.
Yeah, let's look at one of the case studies, one of the biggest brands to get into the country, Safaricom. They launched just a few years ago in the country as the only alternative to state-owned Ethio Telecom. What has changed for consumers in that space?
Well, for consumers, they have options now. For decades, there has only been one state-run telecoms provider, so there's an alternative now. That's a plus. In addition to that, the introduction of Safaricom into Ethiopia has forced Ethio Telecom, the state operator, to be more innovative, to offer its consumers more products, and to essentially increase its creativity and its innovation and try to attract its customers, try to retain its customers. So in that regard, the customers have been beneficiary because of, you know, having this competition. But for Safaricom itself, it has not been an easy ride the past few years because the country has been plagued by various conflicts, which means that it's been difficult for the telecoms operator to move around as it wishes and then to introduce its services. In fact, it's only just this week that Safaricom has launched its operations in the country's northern Tigray region, because that region had been at war for 2 years. And then because of that, there has been massive infrastructure damage, as well as the government had imposed a sort of de facto communications blackouts. In another region, in Amhara, that's the second largest region in the country, currently there has been an internet shutdown for the past 8 or 9 months, which means for the telecoms operator, Safaricom, it's been forced to navigate all these intricacies, all these political and security problems to thrive.
And on that point, Kalkidan, do we have an idea what the foreign investors specifically might be feeling about the political situation, the political instability in Ethiopia? I mean, if you're talking about a company opening about 2 years ago, but only being able to expand to a certain region 2 or 3 years later because of conflict, that's not very good. How's all this affecting the foreign investor appetite to just get into Ethiopia?
Yes, there has been a visible reluctance, or at least caution, from the investor side. If I use the telecom sector as an example, the government has been trying to sell shares from the state-owned Ethio Telecom company, but it had not been successful, which showed a sort of reluctance from the investor side to enter into the market. So now there is this, you know, cautious optimism. The companies and the investors are looking at the country cautiously and trying to see how things will pan out in the coming years. So it would not be surprising to see the same sentiment in the financial sector as well.
Finally then, Kalkidan, what do Ethiopians think about all these economic reforms? Are the reforms popular? Do people like them?
Well, for the people, I would say they would welcome them because, as I said, you know, competition always generates creativity and then provides alternative for the consumers, and they would welcome that. That's what we've seen in the telecom sector. In the banking sector, in the financial sector, we haven't seen much general reaction from the general public yet. But the banks themselves, the domestic banks themselves, have been a little apprehensive about the move. They had been saying that they needed some time to strengthen before the foreign investors are introduced. But the government has been telling them just to prepare themselves. This is inevitable. It's always going to happen, and they have to anticipate that. So it seems that there is a sort of uneasiness among the domestic banks because much more powerful international financial investors are going to come here. And with that, there is a risk of being overwhelmed or swallowed.
Mm. Thank you, Kalkidan. We'll be watching this space. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
That's the BBC's Kalkidan Yibeltal in Addis Ababa. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp. As a podcast listener, you've heard from us before. Today, let's hear from our members about what online therapy has done for them.
I would recommend my therapist 1,000 times over. She has truly changed my life.
The day after my first session, my friends and family said I sounded like myself again for the first time in weeks.
You deserve to invest in your well-being. Visit BetterHelp.com to see what it can do for you. That's better, HELP.com.
17 members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. Players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Service. We now go to Sierra Leone, where there's a push to change the country's child protection laws. The Ministry of Gender and Children Affairs is calling for tougher laws to deal with harmful practices against children, such as female genital mutilation and early marriages. It is worth noting that some of these activities are practiced as part of culture by some communities in the country. Dr. Aisata Mahoi, the minister in charge of the docket, is leading the call to convince community groups, traditional leaders and opinion shapers with a view to getting a new child rights bill for discussion by members of parliament in the country. Let's hear more now from Victor Silva, who's my colleague, is from Sierra Leone and knows a thing or two about what goes on in that country. So, Victor, what is this whole thing about children's rights, and does Sierra Leone already have laws dealing with this?
Yes, indeed. There are laws in Sierra Leone dealing with child rights and whatnot, but the last time they had anything really big and concrete was in 2007. That's quite a while back, 17 years ago. And so the minister thought that because of certain things happening in the country, certain challenges and whatnot, that they should get a new law that should deal with all the things that they have experienced in the recent past.
We've seen that there is an increase in child labor matters in Sierra Leone, child labor and exploitation. We have seen that even also children in conflict with the law. And we have also seen an increase in the number of FGM cases against children in Sierra Leone. So these are the key, these are the main issues that we're looking at and working on in terms of reviewing the old law to get the new one.
Yeah, so that's the Minister for Gender and Children Affairs in Sierra Leone, Dr. Aisata Mahoi. She seems quite keen to get things moving. What other areas, Victor, are of concern to the minister?
Oh, yes. When you talk about child protection, the first thing that goes to the minds of many Sierra Leoneans is female genital mutilation. And the kids have no say over it. And she's of the considered view that whoever wants to do it must be 18 and above.
The issue of FGM, it was not fully addressed. And this is a problem that people consider it to be more political than traditional. For me, I think that we need to have a law that protects children from being forced of being sent into such practices without their consent and also being underage.
So this seems to be as if the minister is suggesting that adult women would have a choice to undergo female genital mutilation if they so choose for whatever reason. Is that correct, Victor?
Yes, indeed. What she has been emphasizing on is that though it's a cultural practice, she is not against it per se, but that whoever wants to go into it has to be 18 and above as an adult. Otherwise, if somebody is below 18, then that's a child. And this whole bill that she's trying to get is to protect the child. If you hear her saying this and other things, this is just to buttress, reinforce what she's already said.
Presently, what we're looking at is how to ensure that FGM is being banned among young people below age 18. Delay in FGM is paramount for us because we will not want a situation where parents will force young girls. What we want is a situation where girls will attain the age 18 and then decide.
So the other risk that the minister might be concerned about is marriages of children, people under 18 years. It's not a problem just in Sierra Leone. It happens in a lot of other African countries as well. And it's a concern. It's an issue of concern across the continent. But what is the plan in Sierra Leone to deal with this?
Well, what she plans to have in the bill that she's advocating for is that previous arrangement which they had whereby somebody decides on behalf of the child that this child is okay, should be registered as go into marriage or some ceremony and whatnot, she says it needs to be looked into again.
The registration of customary marriage, which is now becoming an issue as well, is on the increase for young girls. The young girls are getting married, becoming pregnant at an early age and getting married. So we want to bring stiffer laws that would protect our young people from getting married at an early age, being associated with all types of vulnerabilities as well.
So, Victor, in closing then, what kind of support is this bill or this proposal by the minister likely to have across the country?
Well, the minister, Dr. Aisata Mahoi, has been going around various communities, visiting opinion leaders, people of influence all over the country, and asking them about what they think of what she's trying to propose. And she said that what she's had so far was very encouraging, and that initially they'll put all these things together and then put it in a kind of bill or something and then present it to the people. But of course, it's consultations all the way with the people who are the stakeholders and the people who are affected.
That's my colleague Victor Silva, and we also heard from Dr. Aisata Mahoy, the Minister for Gender and Children Affairs in Sierra Leone. And that's Focus on Africa today. This podcast was produced by Rob Wilson and Victor Silva in London. Susan Gashohi was in Nairobi. Paul Bachibinga was in charge, and Johnny Hall was a technical producer. Alice Mudengi and Andrea Lombard are the editors. Our sister podcast, Africa Daily's next edition, looks at why women are underrepresented in the sciences. Do check it out. I'm Charles Gitonga. We'll talk again next time.
Seventeen members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. The players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.